Does it need to be new today on the world? I'm Carol Hills. Global fashion giant H&M is sinking millions into technology to help recycle your clothing. But isn't there an easier way?
We can get together with a bunch of friends, put on a pot of tea or open a bottle of wine and actually swap the clothing, swap the stories, and a clothing swap is maybe the new shopping.
Swap, don't shop, as we wrap up our wear and tear series. Plus, Donald Trump's ties to Russia go way back. In the late 1980s, the Soviets sent a representative to meet with the future president.
He was wooed by the then Soviet ambassador to the United States, who literally jumped off a plane from Moscow to New York, drove to Trump Tower, took the elevator up, knocked on the door and said, "Hello, Mr. Trump."
Those stories ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. All this week, our Women's Lives desk has been bringing you stories about women across the globe who make our clothes. It's part of our Wear and Tear series, focusing on where our clothes are from and who makes them. And today, we start the show with a closer look at the impact the garment industry has on the environment. Our Livable Planet reporter, Carolyn Beeler, has been looking into that.
That's right, Carol. And I want to start off by asking you, when you go shopping, if you go to the mall to look for a new sweater, say, what are you looking for?
I'm looking for V-neck or round neck, a soft fabric that is not itchy. That's big criteria.
Okay, so cut and fabric, that makes sense. Those are the things we can see about clothing when we're looking at a rack of clothes. Today, I want to talk about what we don't see when we look at clothing, so sort of the inputs that go into making our clothes. So, for example, the T-shirt I'm wearing under my sweater right now took something like 700 gallons of water to grow that cotton and produce that shirt. The only thing we wear more of than cotton is polyester, and globally we emit about 1.5 trillion pounds of greenhouse gases in making polyester each year.
It's amazing to hear this. You know, I have to confess, I just never even think about it. I just kind of put on clothes, but I don't think about the environmental impact.
I think that's true for a lot of us, but the fashion industry is facing more and more public scrutiny for the environmental impact that producing clothing has on the globe. And as they react to that, some brands are trying to be more sustainable and market themselves as sustainable. A big example of that is H&M, the giant fast fashion brand. They talk about being the world's second biggest buyer of so-called better cotton and how they use mostly renewable energy. And for this story, I wanted to zero in on their most sort of consumer-facing sustainability program, which is their garment recycling program.
Okay, let's give the story a listen. It's the latest installment of our Across Women's Lives Wear and Tear series.
H&M does not shy away from touting its commitment to the environment in its advertising.
Creativity and sustainability aren't in opposition.
This 2015 ad has actress Olivia Wilde wearing H&M's first Conscious Exclusive collection, which is made with sustainable materials.
Style and awareness, not one or the other.
But it's H&M's garment recycling program that the company highlights most in its stores, like the one I went to recently in a mall outside of Boston.
So if you walk into one of its stores, like I just did here, you'll see that some of the clothes have a green tag that say H&M Conscious. So I'm looking at a pair of distressed skinny jeans. And if you open up the tag, you'll see that these jeans were made from 21% recycled cotton. At the front of the store near the cash register, there's also a big white bin that looks kind of like a trash can, but it's a recycling bin, and it has a green sign on it that says, "Recycle your unwanted clothes at H&M and get 15% off." Now, this is part of H&M's probably most visible and highly advertised sustainability program, which is its garment take-back and recycling program.
Hello, good morning.
I wanted to learn more about this recycling program, so I called up H&M.
I am Katerina Midby. I am the sustainability manager at H&M UK and Ireland.
Midby tells me that when clothes are donated, they're taken to sorting and recycling plants that H&M contracts with. Everything collected in Europe goes to this massive plant in Germany. Video of the facility shows these bags of clothes hanging from the ceiling, being dumped into containers, and then the clothes are hand-sorted by workers into different hampers.
Around 60% goes to secondhand and vintage. What cannot be reworn will be reused and repurposed for things like cleaning cloths, insulation for houses and cars, and other products.
H&M advertises its recycling program as an effort to close the loop.
With your help, We literally turn your old clothes into new garments.
But that actually only happens with a tiny percentage of collected clothing.
A small part of it, between 5 and 10%, goes to recycling into new fibers and ultimately new clothes.
Only 5 to 10%. And only 0.7%, that's less than 1%, of all the materials in H&M's new clothes come from recycled materials. That's partly because to recycle fabric, H&M mechanically shreds it, which shortens and weakens fibers. Textile makers generally mix recycled fibers with lots of virgin material to make fabric that's strong enough to use in clothing. But there might be another way.
What we are exploring is alternative ways of breaking things down.
This is Edwin Kay, who's in a gleaming white lab at the Hong Kong Research Institute of Textiles and Apparel.
Where we are right now is in our hydrothermal lab.
The H&M Foundation is donating roughly $7 million over 4 years to fund researchers here looking for better ways to recycle fabric. Stainless steel equipment lines the lab's walls. Using some of it, Kay's team has developed a way to separate cotton and polyester fibers, which can't currently be done with mechanical shredding, while doing less damage to those fibers.
So let me show you the hydrothermal equipment that we're using for this particular project. So come on over here.
Kay points out a tall silver machine that holds a large black canister.
Can we open this chamber up?
Kay's colleague demonstrates how to open the chamber where they put fabric to recycle. They add water, heat, pressure, and a small amount of chemicals. When it's all done, polyester and cotton fibers from fabric separate out without being mechanically shredded.
Here's the output. So I'm holding a bag full of material. You can see this is several pounds of polyester. Because we haven't done anything mechanical to it, all we have to do is re-spin it, and we can make fibers out of this right away.
Kay's team isn't the first to do this in a lab. The hard part is scaling it up. But Kay is optimistic enough that he's building a factory nearby.
We hope to be able to start manufacturing in bulk the recycled material by the end of 2018, if possible.
Still, even if industrial-scale recycling for cotton-polyester blends does become a reality, it would be hard for any recycling program to make a dent in the giant pile of cast-offs H&M creates. Since spring of 2013, the company has collected the equivalent of about 260 million T-shirts. They don't disclose their production figures, but an outside estimate suggests they produced roughly a billion garments just last year.
It's nothing. It's nothing. Whatever it is that they've collected is nothing.
This is Ursula de Castro, who's co-founder of Fashion Revolution, a nonprofit that pushes for transparency and sustainability in the industry.
And this is where the problem lies, because they're working on the technology to recycle, but they haven't got the way to collect effectively.
De Castro gives H&M credit for making environmental sustainability a priority.
The intention is there. They've realized the scale of the problem, and the investment is that they are putting money where their mouths is.
But in inviting customers to help close the loop, H&M is hinting at a waste-free fashion industry that's not possible with today's technologies. So I asked H&M's Katerina Midby, is sustainable fast fashion an oxymoron?
No, not really. I mean, you could always argue that, of course, in order to be really sustainable, you should cut down on your consumption. But at the same time, you are a fashion company and we don't really want to compromise fashion for sustainability. But I don't think you have to these days.
Fashion Revolution's Ursula de Castro disagrees.
They have to compromise. They absolutely must compromise.
As long as producing fabric has such a big environmental impact and recycling textiles is so deeply flawed, De Castro says clothing brands will face trade-offs between sustainability and fashion, and so will consumers.
The World's Carolyn Beeler is here in the studio with me. So I guess we can conclude that recycling is not a big panacea for the problem of clothing and its impact on the environment. So what can we do?
The biggest answer, Carol, is just to buy less clothing so that less cotton and polyester gets made and dyed and shipped and transported and washed and ultimately probably thrown out.
That's sort of the lesson I've been gathering from all our coverage of the fashion industry this week. But we've heard it all before. And what strategies are there that's really kind of moving this forward?
So while I was at that mall, not far from our studios, I met up with a sustainable fashion author and blogger at Magnifico.com named Kate Black to ask her this question. And she gave me some tips.
I think the very first question should be, do I need to buy it and does it need to be new? So if it's a trend piece, then can I buy it in a thrift shop? Can I borrow it from a friend who I know has that perfect thing that I need for this occasion?
Instead of a shopping trip at the beginning of a new season, Black recommends organizing a clothing swap.
We can get together with a bunch of friends, put on a pot of tea or open a bottle of wine and actually swap the clothing, swap the stories, and a clothing swap is maybe the new shopping.
You know what? It's a great idea, but I don't think a lot of people are going to do that. People love to buy clothes.
Carol, I'm actually wearing a skirt I got at a clothing swap. So Some people do. It's a great solution sometimes.
Okay, but what about those things where you're out there and you think, I've got to have this, when you really want the item?
Yeah, if you really know you need something, Black recommends doing your research, buying from brands whose environmental record you trust, which takes some work, and try looking and thinking about quality more than the price tag when you're looking at a piece of clothing.
You need to think about the durability and like almost the cost per wear. So if you're spending, let's say, $10 on something that's only going to last you one wash, what if you paid $40 and it was something that lasted you a whole year and 52 wears?
Carol, a really interesting stat I came across in this reporting is that the price of consumer goods overall in the past 20 years has increased by somewhere between 50 and 60%. But the price of clothing has remained about constant. So clothing is comparatively cheap, and we just have this urge to buy and buy and buy, and we need to sort of look beyond the price tag.
That's what I was thinking, because as long as clothing is cheap, and it's relatively cheap these days, that's what fuels the buying. And so the mass of buying is going to be on the cheaper clothes because, you know, it's sort of a cycle.
Yeah. And then once we buy things, some of the environmental footprint also comes from how we care for them. So Kate Black recommends washing in cold water and hanging dry, which both saves energy and prolongs the life of your clothes. And then when you're done with your clothes, Black does say do not throw them in the trash. Even though most of our old clothes can't be made into new clothes, there still is a use for a lot of them.
A lot of people look at something like a Holy t-shirt and they think, this can't be of use, I should not put it in a donation bin. And what they don't understand is that there's a ragging industry. We shred that kind of material and put it into insulation. Even though it might not seem to you like it has a second use as clothing, there still is an additional life for all the fibers that we find in this mall.
So while recycling can't be the whole fix, it can be a small part of how we make what we wear more sustainable.
Thanks, Carolyn. Carolyn Beeler is with our Livable Planet desk, and all of us can learn more about the clothes we wear. In fact, flip the tag on the back of your shirt and take our How Fair Is Your Fashion quiz. You put in the information on the tag or label, and we give you some insight about where the item was made, what it's made out of, and how responsible the brand is. Check out our How Fair Is Your Fashion quiz at PRI.org. A quick preview now for a story we'll have for you on Monday. It has an unexpected twist. A former Marine got drunk one night, pulled out his rifle, and fired on a mosque. That was 2 years ago. Members of the mosque took action by forgiving him.
I was a hater. Look at my Facebook. I was an actual hater. And then just spending some time with him, you realize, oh, I was terribly wrong.
A member of that mosque went to see the shooter in prison.
So when I first saw him, he's not walking in arrogance or pride. He's bending over a little bit, has red cheeks, teary eyes, and you can tell by his body language and his eyes that he's remorseful, he's sorry, this is against his character, you know, even before any words were said.
How a mosque in Connecticut is changing attitudes about Islam. Our story from Meriden, Connecticut, coming up on the show on Monday. And still ahead today, how some authorities in Quebec want to regulate the way shopkeepers and waiters say hello. That's right here on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. When it comes to Russian interference in last year's election and the alleged collusion with the Trump campaign, we know a few things. First, that U.S. intelligence agencies believe Russia tried to sway the election. We also know that a special counsel is looking into whether the Trump campaign colluded with this. And we know that former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn has admitted lying to the FBI. But there's still that bigger question we all have, says The Guardian's Luke Harding.
The big question is whether Russia nudged Donald Trump across the finishing line. I think in a way it's unanswerable, but what we can say is that there was an extensive operation to help.
Harding says that operation included the hacked Democratic Party emails and those secret meetings between Russians and members of Trump's team. Harding explores all of that and more in his new book. It's called Collusion: How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. Now, one of the things you focus on is Trump's historical connections to Russia. What of those connections give you insight into the accusations?
Well, I think to understand the extraordinary events of 2016, you need to get back to the days of the Cold War and to a long tradition of kind of Kremlin espionage. And I think what's key to this is Trump's 1987 visit to Soviet Moscow. One of the things I discovered was that he was wooed by the then Soviet ambassador to the United States, who literally jumped off a plane from Moscow to New York, drove to Trump Tower, took the elevator up, knocked on the door and said, "Hello, Mr. Trump. You've built the most wonderful building in America." And there was a kind of courtship with Trump invited on an all expenses paid trip to Moscow. And what's important about this is the context. This, according to my sources, was a sort of classic cultivation operation. That doesn't mean that Trump joined the KGB, but it does mean the Soviet government was interested in him, spent hard currency on him. And when he got back from the trip, a few weeks later, he took out adverts criticizing Ronald Reagan's foreign policy and said for the first time he was interested in becoming president. So I think these kind of methods of influence and cultivation are really kind of key to all this.
But that was back in the 80s. What about more recently?
Well, I think this was a kind of on-off thing. And one of the things I explore in my book is the dossier by Christopher Steele, the former British intelligence officer who set this whole scandal rolling with his reports that were published in January of this year. And what he alleges is there was essentially a kind of well-developed relationship between the Russians and Donald Trump going back, he says, at least 5 years, certainly to another Trump trip to Moscow in 2013 for the Miss Universe beauty pageant. And this was a kind of two-way street with Trump supplying information allegedly on Russian oligarchs in the States and the Kremlin feeding Trump political intelligence on Hillary and on other kind of rivals and basically kind of helping to shape his presidential campaign.
What do you think the Kremlin will learn from this experience? I mean, do you think they'll conclude, "Oh, that was a good thing. We were successful," or do you think, "Wow, next time we probably should have hands off"?
No, I mean, I think firstly that there will have been. Bear in mind that the Russian side of this operation is all a state secret, and we're going to have to wait a very long time until Putin is gone before we discover the kind of full scale of it. But there will have been medals pinned in secret to celebrate this. A lot of intelligence officers in Moscow will have got promotion. I've talked to American intelligence people who basically regard what happened last year as one of the greatest espionage operations ever. Not that Putin is Superman, but that he very cleverly, using hacking, using Facebook, using trolls, exploited divisions which already existed in American society to help Donald Trump. And I think the conclusion, the corollary of all this, is do it again, do it better, whether it's in 2018 or 2020. I mean, Putin isn't going to take his foot off the pedal. He's going to press down harder next time.
Luke Harding's new book is called Collusion: How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. Thanks so much, Luke.
Thank you.
On Wednesday, President Trump brought up the war in Yemen, where the ongoing civil war has killed nearly 10,000 people and caused a humanitarian crisis. Trump told reporters that he was asking Saudi Arabia, which supports one side in the war, to allow humanitarian aid through its blockade of air, sea, and border crossings. In Yemen, people were skeptical. After all, the U.S. has supported Saudi Arabia's blockade for nearly 3 years. Also, Yemenis are distracted now by the assassination last weekend of former President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Since then, the rebels, known as the Houthis, have cracked down on communications, blocking most social media. In the capital city, Sana'a, people are laying low. We reached a young Yemeni woman there. We're not saying her name to protect her identity, but we can say she's a humanitarian worker in Sana'a. And we asked her for her reaction to what Trump said about the blockade.
I don't know about President Trump. He's an attention seeker. He's always going for something like nobody did before. Like when he asked Saudi to let humanitarian aid to go into Yemen, this is kind of a joke for me, and we don't believe this. Since last Wednesday, actually almost like 9 days now, we just staying inside our houses because you don't know if the airstrike gonna come, like Houthi's gonna hit. It's like it's safer for you and your family to stay close to your house. And I kept myself busy, you know, I work like, you know, plan day by day plan. Because everything is changing, even how to get the food and water. I have a dog. I don't know, it's a kind of forbidden in Islam, but I have it anyway. His name is Broco. I love him so much. And I keep communicate with my friends, my colleagues, also to discuss what we're going to do, if there is something we can do. Since 2011, we have this kind of ugly experience of lockdown in our houses for days and days. But this one is different. This one, it's like most of the people, just like, they are sad, really sad. Even myself, I have like, since I was a student, I have issues like with the old regime and, you know, the troubles and education and everything. But when Ali Salas got killed, I cried. Most of the people really cried, men and women. They feel like, you know, this man has been our leader for almost over 35 years. I'm 26, I born, and he's still like, you know, he was the president until I finished the school, and he's still the president. We always look up to him. He's our father for my generation. But now the thing that I noticed, it's like people, like, I don't know, they lost hope. Ali Abdullah Saleh's death breaks every single one in the country because they think there is no protection anymore.
A young woman locked down in Sana'a, giving us her first-person account of life right now in the Yemeni capital. I'm Carol Hills. There's controversy brewing in French-speaking Montreal, where shopkeepers and waiters often go bilingual.
When I get to the customer table, I say bonjour, hi. So that way, when they respond, I can know if the person speaks English or French.
But now it might be au revoir to bonjour, hi. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. 2 years ago, the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean was all over the global headlines. Thousands of people, many of them refugees from the war in Syria, were making desperate attempts to reach Europe. Many of them boarded overcrowded rafts and dinghies in an attempt to cross from Turkey to Greece, often with horrific outcomes. Who can forget the image of the young boy Aylan Kurdi, drowned and washed up on a beach? Eventually, Europe managed to stop the mass crossings, mostly by cutting a deal with Turkey. What you may not realize, though, is that thousands of migrants are still exactly where they were when that deal was struck, in Greece. And now there's been an uptick in new arrivals. The World's Rich Hall has been visiting the camps on the Greek island of Lesbos, and that's where we're reaching him today. Rich, paint a picture of these camps for us. What do they look like, and how permanent have they become?
Well, I was in Moria camp today, which is the largest on Lesbos Island. And this was a camp that was built originally for around 2,000 people. And it now has more than 6,000 people there. So you can kind of imagine what that does to the conditions there. I walked through earlier and it was just so overcrowded. There were kids everywhere. People are living in whatever shelter they can find.
What effect is the overcrowding having on the refugees?
Well, if you talk to any of the aid workers here, they'll tell you it's having a really dramatic effect on people. There's all sorts of health problems, not just physical health, but mental health. I actually went to a children's clinic run by Médecins Sans Frontières just outside the camp earlier, and I met with Gemma Gili, who told me what was going on.
The main things are the obvious, well, we say obvious, but what you'd expect for them living in the conditions they are, which is upper respiratory tract infections, so colds and coughs, upset stomachs, watery diarrhea, because as you're soon going to see, the conditions inside are really disgusting. So, and they are sleeping in such close quarters that they're very, very, because they're children and they have a weaker immune system, they're very susceptible to illnesses like that.
Rich, how did things get so bad?
There's a combination of things, really. One is that there's been a huge uptick in the number of people arriving here. People think the migrant crisis ended in 2015, but violence in Iraq and Syria is still going on. We recently had the liberation of Mosul in Iraq and the liberation of Raqqa in Syria, and that has sent another wave of people coming here. I spoke to one aid worker here earlier who told me that around 100 people are arriving every day, and they haven't seen those numbers here for a while. So it's a combination of more people arriving, and that is kind of overwhelming people here. Another reason is that aid groups have been leaving. Because the worst of the migrant crisis has ended, funds are kind of drying up on the island, so not all the aid groups that were here in 2015 are still here. And so it's a combination of those extra numbers coming and aid groups leaving that's causing the conditions here.
I mean, how often are people processed and moved on, and where do they go?
If they're processed, they're moved on to the Greek mainland. It's difficult to know the numbers, really. But the Greek government actually announced today that they will be transferring around 5,000 people from the Greek islands to the mainland to try and alleviate this crisis that's taking place on Lesbos and on the islands here. So that should go some way to alleviate it. But again, I spoke to aid workers here and they were skeptical. They said until we see people actually being moved, we're still going to keep up the pressure.
And if they are moved to the mainland, will they just be moved into another camp waiting for processing?
Yes, yeah, exactly. But the conditions there are significantly better. There's just more space and more resources to deal with it. This is an island. It's really difficult for people to get help here and to get resources here. So that's one of the reasons why it's so bad.
Rich, you're on Lesbos, and when you drive around, is it like an island full of refugees, or is it an island where there's just kind of normal life happening, and then there's this part of the island where there's these thousands and thousands of refugees?
That's a good question. It's both, actually. I was thinking about this earlier. I was driving along one side of the island. It looks like a beautiful, picturesque holiday town, a medieval town with no sign of any trouble or any problems at all. Then you hit an area where the refugee camps are, and the scene completely changes. You start seeing hordes of people everywhere, just people walking down the streets, some people walking to the supermarket, carrying bags, obviously not looking in great condition. So the atmosphere just changes dramatically. And if you go into the main towns and the main port areas here, you'll see lots of refugees and migrants. So it's deceptive sometimes when you're in some parts of the island, but Lesbos has definitely been hugely affected by this crisis, and it's just struggling under the weight of so many people coming to their small island.
The World's Rich Hall speaking to us from the Greek island of Lesbos. Thanks, Rich.
Thanks, Carol.
A lot of those migrants in Lesbos hope to make it to other countries like Germany, which has been taking in large numbers of refugees over the past few years. And so no surprise then that the migrant issue has turned into a hot topic in Germany. Over the past couple of days, for example, German media have been reporting that some pilots have refused to take back refugees whose asylum applications have been rejected. The World's Shirin Jafari has been looking into this. Shirin, what's going on?
Here's what we know, Carol. Pilots from some of Germany's biggest airlines have been refusing to take back refugees to Afghanistan. And this is something that's been going on for at least a year. I contacted Lufthansa, which is the biggest airline in Germany, and they told me that there have been at least 222 instances where pilots have declined to take Afghan refugees back to Afghanistan.
And are they declining out of sympathy for the refugees or some other reason?
It's interesting because initially when the story came out, we thought that these pilots are doing this out of sympathy, which could be true. I mean, you know, Afghanistan is not a safe place, and some of these pilots may be feeling that they're playing a role in sending someone to a dangerous place. But that's not the whole story. The Lufthansa official told me that pilots also do this because of security reasons. A few years ago, he said two refugees died on Lufthansa flights. One case happened in 1999. That was when a Sudanese refugee resisted being deported. And so on the flight, he was bound to his chair and they put a helmet on his head. That was to stop him from hurting himself. In the end, they found him dead. He was suffocated.
That's unbelievable. That couldn't have been good for Lufthansa.
Yeah, actually, it got a lot of attention, that case. And in fact, Lufthansa changed its policy towards refugees and returning refugees to their countries. The policy now is that the pilot is the person who makes the decision on whether or not a passenger stays on a flight or not. In some of the recent cases, the pilots felt that if an Afghan refugee is being sent back to a place where they don't want to be sent back to, they might potentially pose a threat to themselves or to other passengers on the plane.
So it's a little bit more complicated. It's not just sympathy, but also concern about safety and et cetera. What do we know about these Afghans who are being deported?
I managed to reach one young man. His name is Ramin Mohabbat.
Ramin Mohabbat astam khabarnagari re danishgah Herat khondam.
He doesn't speak English, so we spoke in Dari. It's very close to the language I speak, Farsi. He told me that until just recently, he was one of the Afghans who faced deportation. He got a letter in the mail from the German government, and it said that he has 30 days to go back to Afghanistan. He's telling me here how shocked he was when he got the letter.
What's his story?
Ramin was a journalist back in Afghanistan, and he published a couple of stories that the Taliban weren't happy about. So they went after him. And after a while, he just didn't feel safe anymore, and he decided to leave Afghanistan, and he wanted to get to Europe. He went to several different countries before he finally landed in Germany. He told me that at one point in the journey, he saw death with his own eyes. He was on a boat from Turkey to Greece. And so finally he makes it to Germany, and then after 2 years of living in limbo, he gets a letter from the government that says he only has 30 days to leave and go back to Afghanistan.
So is he going to go back?
Ramin is one of the luckier ones. He's extremely sharp and dogged. He managed to come up with more evidence to show that his life is in danger in Afghanistan. And so finally, after a lot of back and forth, the German government agreed to let him stay.
So are the pilots going to continue to make the final decision about who they transport back?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like this is airline policy, and they get to decide who is going to fly on their aircraft or not. And it looks like this is going to continue. I was really curious. I wanted to ask Ramin what he would say if he got a chance to talk with one of these pilots. He's saying he's going to make them a big batch of saffron tea and offer them some Afghan sweets and pastries.
Fascinating story. The World's Shirin Jafari. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Carol.
All right, you fans of The Crown, get ready to binge. Season 2 of the Netflix hit is finally out. Here's an appetizer. Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip discussing their rocky marriage.
Look, I realize this marriage has turned out to be something quite different to what we both imagined.
Understatement.
And that we find ourselves in a...
prison.
A situation that is unique. The exit route, which is open to everyone else.
Divorce.
Yes, divorce. It's not an option for us. Ever.
10 fresh episodes of The Crown drop today, as well as a new soundtrack. Adeline Sear has been listening to that soundtrack and talking to the composers.
British film composer Rupert Gregson-Williams has scored a lot of blockbusters such as The Legend of Tarzan, Hacksaw Ridge, and Wonder Woman. But for the Netflix award-winning series The Crown, Gregson-Williams went for a haunting sound, starting with the opening credits theme. As we see liquid gold shoots stretching into parts of a crown, a dark melody builds into a grand overture. Gregson-Williams says he and his fellow composers received precise instructions from series creator Peter Morgan about evoking Britain's post-war period.
Peter Morgan was very specific about how he wanted to feel like we had tectonic plates shifting in the world, but he wanted it to feel regal but without being pompous. And we had lots of conversations. In fact, that theme took quite a long time, a lot of time talking and not writing, and then eventually we got it.
The theme is inspired by an aria by 17th century English composer Henry Purcell, who in his day wrote music for English monarchs. The Crown's season one focused on the birth of a queen, a young woman stepping into a demanding role with apprehension. In an early scene, we see Elizabeth II, played by Claire Foy, trying to walk with her heavy crown.
It's not as easy as it looks. Do you suppose I could borrow it for a couple of days? Just to practice?
The music in this season reflects a sense of awe and wonder. But season two hits a darker tone, reflected in a bigger and more menacing orchestral sound. Co-composer Lauren Balfe explains.
They've matured. So the Queen is now a reigning monarch instead of a young girl given this position. It's a different journey for them, and that's why the music evolves.
The world has changed. Society in Britain has changed.
You married a wild spirit. Trying to tame them is no use.
This restlessness of yours, it has to be a thing of the past.
Queen Elizabeth is dealing with an increasingly strained marriage, scandals that threaten the crown, and headlines that call her an out-of-touch monarch. And an international crisis rocks the country, the Suez Canal crisis, which leads to the resignation of Prime Minister Anthony Eden. Netflix says the second season bears witness to the end of the age of deference and ushers in the revolutionary era of the 1960s. And in this story, much of that sentiment is carried by Princess Margaret.
I know who I am, a woman for the modern age, free to live, to love, and free to break away.
She was just a completely different animal and always trying to break out of the mould of the royal family. And that's where the difference is, you know, Elizabeth still living in pre-war times and Margaret trying to be something a little bit more modern, you know.
In this series that paints intimate portraits of royalty and chronicles major events of the 20th century, the music is as stirring as the story. For The World, Aline Cyr, Paris.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Nina Porzucchi is in the studio with me. She's one half of our podcast about language, The World in Words.
Hey, Carol. So I got a quick quiz for you. Which province of Canada is officially bilingual?
I'm going to say Ontario.
Wrong. The only officially bilingual province is New Brunswick.
Really?
Yeah. Some might say that the province of Quebec...
Yes, that might, would be the obvious one,
right, but wrong. Right. But actually, the province of Quebec, the official language is French and only French, and it was made official in 1974. But if you've ever been up to Montreal, you may hear people speaking both English and French. There's most of the city is actually bilingual. And last week, there was a bit of a language kerfuffle when politicians in Quebec's assembly pushed through a resolution asking shopkeepers, waiters, business people, to just say bonjour instead of bonjour hi as a greeting when customers come into their stores.
Me, when I get to the customer table, I say bonjour hi. So that way, with the response, I can know if the person speaks English or French.
So that was Benoit Moreau. He is actually my waiter. One morning when I was in Montreal and I was reading the headlines about this, and the Montrealers I spoke with were pretty torn up about this.
I always thought it was the best asset to have two languages.
Luc Mean works the front desk of a fancy hotel downtown.
I mean, the more languages you speak, the more you can communicate with people. it's an asset, and they make it seem like it's a disadvantage to know more languages.
But not everybody agrees with Mean.
I work at the airport, that's what we use. But otherwise in Montreal, I don't think it's appropriate. I would only use bonjour, and afterwards if the people start talking English, or the proper way, I think, is to ask, do you speak English?
Wow, I'm really surprised by this. It seems really kind of nitpicking, but maybe I'm just being a language imperialist. What I'm curious about is, will shopkeepers actually get penalized if they continue to use the bonjour hi?
No, not at all. This was mostly a symbolic resolution. The assembly wants to try and avoid sparking another Pasta gate.
You've got to explain that one.
So back in 2013, a French language inspector tried to crack down on an Italian restaurant in Montreal for having words like pasta and calamari on its menu without its French translation. And it was a bit of a PR nightmare.
So the French word for pasta is
pâte.
Ah.
I think I got that right.
So what's prompted this row now over the bonjour hi?
There are a couple of reasons. I mean, language has always been a really sensitive issue in Quebec. But one big incident was there was a recent grand opening of an Adidas store in downtown Montreal. And at the opening of the store, at the ceremony, the manager was fairly dismissive about speaking French. He said, quote, "I will say a word in French to accommodate the city of Montreal and the Francophone media."
Ooh, yes. That's fighting words up in Montreal.
Right. So people didn't appreciate that too much. There was a call to boycott Adidas, and, you know, then and there was the formal apology. And then, you know, you can imagine a lot of hand-wringing.
Is the French language really under attack in Montreal?
I think attack is a pretty strong word. However, another cause for the resolution was the release of census data on language, which showed that 94% of Quebecers spoke French at work, but that bilingualism is actually on the rise. And there was a tiny drop of people who spoke only French at work and not a word of English. So there's a little bit of fear about French slipping. But I learned there is a truly bilingual solution to this bonjour hi business, at least according to one shop owner I met, François Patenon.
Hello.
Did you catch that greeting?
Hello.
Yes.
I say hello. It's like, could be in any language.
That's right. Hello. It's the bilingual solution, Carol.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit French or really anything.
Hello.
Yeah. Nina Porzuki, one half of our language podcast, The World in Words. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, Nina.
Merci. Thanks, Carol.
Finally today, let's head to Cuba via the music of Telmari Diaz. Diaz is on a U.S. tour right now, but she faced some challenges getting here. Earlier, she told Marco Werman that some of her band members couldn't get their visas in time, in part because the U.S. embassy in Havana is partially closed. That's due to those recent sonic attacks, which have affected diplomats there. So Diaz and her team had to work around that.
What we do is we have to travel to Mexico, so which was a new challenge. We have to go to Mexico, go to the American consulate in Mexico, and trying to get the visa and our passport. And that's how we ended up bringing at least half of the band to the States. It was a completely, it was a nightmare, but we did it.
What a challenging visa application. I mean, you really had to improvise. And half of your band is still in Havana, though, you said.
Yes. And I have to say that, sadly, one of the guys, the director of the band, he was denied with no any clear or reasonable, explanation.
You were in New Orleans for Jazz Fest earlier this year. What strikes you about the United States right now? Does it feel different from, like, 8 months ago?
Oh, yeah. Of course it is. Like, the way that we arrived to New Orleans and how even the questions that they, you know, that they ask at the customs, I feel like it's a disaster, like we are living right now. Everything that we were, you know, like it was getting better, the relationship with the States, now it's again like even worse than the beginning. Of course, the energy, the good energy with the people is the same, with all the people who organize the events and all, you know, the beautiful people is the beautiful people.
And the shows have been good?
The shows have been amazing. A great response with, you know, a lot of energy for all the community, not just the Cuban or Latin American community, but just the people, you know, from here, from America, that they support us, that they dance with us, that they recognize, you know, all the effort that we've been doing to be here and perform, because, you know, music is a universal language. Music gotta win. Music gotta be, you know, over all these kind of bureaucracy problems, you know.
So when you get back to Cuba, what are you going to tell people about this experience, this kind of schizophrenic experience of yours here in America?
I would say the people of United States remain the same, with the same feeling to know, to get to know Cuba, to get to know the real Cuba that has been like a taboo for so many years. But unfortunately, you know, I don't think the government is in the same position.
Cuban hip-hop artist Telmari Diaz speaking earlier this week with Marco Werman.
They can't stop stopping us. They can't stop stopping us.
Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
Cuando tus ojos, mis ojos, éxtasis, clímax. Viento azul, azul, tu vida, tu aura, naranja, tu energía. La fría mañana sana de mis frutas trae la brisa, la lisa libertad de tu sonrisa. Canjeando paz por más energía divina, abrazándote, mira.
PRI, Public Radio International.